I'm not really sure what the concept is at this point. I'm just thinking of like ideas and words. Zebra, vacuum, tornado.
This is the Extra Hot Break Podcast, episode 394 for the week of February 14th, 2022. I am indentured card laborer David T. Cole, and I'm here with concrete butthole Sarah D. Bunting.
Ow.
And pit in your juice, Tara Ariano.
Who wouldn't want me? Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. We are, full disclosure, pre-taping this episode, and we are listening to and evaluating some canon pitches from listeners just like you. We each chose one from our list of submissions. Is everyone ready? Shall we just get into it?
It's time for canon number one. It comes from Karen. Take it away, Karen.
Hey guys, I'm pitching an episode of the OC for the canon. No, not that OC. The Odd Couple, season 2, episode 4, Sleepwalker. Okay, I know this is an episode of a sitcom that first aired in 1971. That's 50 years ago. That's already going to rule it out for some people. Stipulated. Also, this was a TV show from Gary Marshall, who some people might only know from crap like New Year's Eve or sitcoms like Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and Mork and Mindy, where you had to wait 10 minutes for the audience to stop clapping at every actor's entrance. But if you grew up in what's sometimes called the New York metropolitan area or the tri-state area, which I think Sarah did and I definitely did, you may have stumbled across reruns of The Odd Couple on WPIX during a baseball rainout. If not, I think the story of a sloppy sports writer and a fussy photographer trying to live together holds up surprisingly well. So I'm pitching season 2, episode 4, Sleepwalker, as a classic example and the perfect entry point because it takes place entirely in their apartment with no special guest stars, no stunts, and epitomizes the premise, which is, as stated in the intro, can two divorced men share an apartment without driving each other crazy? The episode begins with Oscar, Jack Klugman, and his girlfriend Nancy, Joan Hotchkiss, celebrating their anniversary, for which he served red wine and fish sticks, and is now opening a bottle of champagne, which he says is good stuff, because it's from Canada. Nancy is wearing a fascinating floral two-piece pantsuit with wide legs and wide collar, and looks really comfortable. Nancy is also a doctor, which is just a fact that no one makes a big deal out of in 1971, though Oscar calls her his lady doctor in this episode, but I don't know, maybe he's being cute. Just as they start to get down to business, Felix, Tony Randall, comes home early because he's not feeling well and interrupts this private celebration. By the way, Felix is wearing a tuxedo, which I don't think is ever explained, but it doesn't need to be. It's Felix. He loves opera and ballet. It's a great detail. We understand it. Oscar gets annoyed at the interruption and overreacts, as he usually does. Here he complains to Nancy, clip one.
It's every night, every day lives inside me like a tapeworm, eating away my nerve endings, gnawing.
Nancy advises him to try being more tolerant to Felix, mostly for his health. So the next morning, Oscar takes her advice and makes Felix breakfast. And of course, it's not good enough. Felix makes a big deal about the pits in his juice and his undercooked eggs. Later, Oscar is late for dinner and Felix passive-aggressively sitting in... Later, Oscar is late for dinner, and Felix, passive-aggressively sitting with the ruined rump roast in the pot in his lap, gives him crap for it. In the process, Oscar explains he's trying to be less annoyed by Felix, to which Felix says, clip two.
I think you're onto something with this new attitude of yours. But instead of working at not being annoyed at me, you should stop being annoying to me. There's your project. I'll get a saw and cut the meat.
Felix is still giving Oscar crap before bed, and Oscar is still practicing tolerance. He's taking it, but barely containing his rage. Clip three.
Those eggs you made for me this morning were short turkeys. That's a joke, Oscar. What?
That's a laugh, Felix.
You don't mind when I rib you, do you, Oscar?
No, Oh, I love a good ribbing, Phil.
Later, a sleeping Oscar hears Felix's voice in his head. Clip 4.
I don't like pits. 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 My juice. 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 I don't like pits. 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 My juice. Juice. Juice.
Pits. 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 In my juice. Juice! Juice!
Oscar starts sleepwalking, somehow grabbing a rolled-up newspaper on the way to Felix's room, and hits a sleeping Felix on the head. The next morning, Felix is tired and grumpy, tells Oscar about this weird dream he had, but later finds the rolled-up newspaper in Oscar's bed. He calls in their pal, sweet-bumbling policeman Murray, Al Molinaro, and by the way, there's a depiction of law enforcement you would not see today, who suggests it might be sleepwalking. Oscar hits Felix again, but Murray does not witness the hit. Still wanting to catch him in the act, Felix sets up a camera with a tripwire in Oscar's bedroom, but Oscar smacks him before he's done with the setup. Felix piles furniture in front of his bedroom door, which Oscar plows through, but this time Felix throws on a nearby flak helmet, grabs his camera in time to take the picture before he gets smacked. Oscar, all the while still sleeping, then lifts up Felix's helmet and hits him again. The next morning, while Oscar is looking at the photographic evidence and feeling guilty, Felix is getting ready to move out, blaming himself. Clip 5.
There's something in me that brings out this ugly, animal, terrible viciousness. I'm a bad seed, Oscar.
Felix starts crying, and that's Oscar's limit. He has no choice but to start yelling again. Clip 6.
But I can't take you being a martyr. I refuse to live with Joan of Arc. So you take your pots and your pitch, and take your pills and your pains, and take your pots and your pants and your pounding, and pull out!
That's what's been missing, Oscar. You haven't been yelling at me.
I've been trying to be nice to you.
Aha! That's it!
What's it?
Hostility, repressed during the day, erupts at night. Freud, dreams in the subconscious. I know that's the answer.
First of all, take your pats and your pits and take your pills and your pains and take your pots and your pans and your pouting and pull out. That is awesome. That is some nice alliteration there. Not many shows would bother. Second of all, it was the 70s, so of course, the answer is Freud. Freudian psychoanalysis was pretty much the entire story of American psychiatry from World War II till like the late 70s, early 80s. And that's clear if you watch older TV. Think about how many times you've seen people lying on the couch and revealing their innermost thoughts on mid-century TV shows. And you can see why that would work for a storytelling medium like television, as opposed to handing someone a prescription based on their neurochemistry. Anyway, Felix's prescription for Oscar, to ensure they can keep living together and the show will continue, is that Oscar should never be nice to him. He drinks Oscar's juice, tells him it's great, and spits out the pits after he leaves. So you know they're never really going to get along, and they're going to keep living together until the series finale. Not really a spoiler. So there's really no stakes, but it doesn't matter. This is character-based, not caricature-based, comedy. And the characters are not just messy versus neat, but aggressive versus passive-aggressive, lowbrow versus highbrow, chaotic versus orderly, naturalistic versus mannered. And Klugman and Randall are hilarious, total pros with a chemistry and warmth that was never matched again in any of the reboots since Neil Simon wrote the play in 1965, because the reboots all seem to forget that these people are friends. They like each other, and they're likable. I know the rhythms of a taped in front of a live audience sitcom can rankle, but it's actually what the show needed. The weaker first season was single camera with laugh track, which both stars hated because they were theater vets. And sure enough, in season 2, they switched to 3 cameras taped in front of a live audience, and the show found its footing. And yes, the show is a product of its time. The Can Two Divorced Men intro was added at the behest of ABC, so no one would think they were gay. But also a product of its time, middle-aged people who look like middle-aged people, and also just middle-aged people on TV in general. I mean, here's the breakdown of the ages of the cast of this episode. Tony Randall, 51. Jack Klugman, 49. Joan Hotchkiss, 44. Not bad, only 5 years younger than Klugman. Pretty good for television. Al Molinaro, 52. And it's fine. They look fine. We can handle looking at them. But it would never happen today. By the way, Joan Hotchkiss, who also wrote an acting manual, is the only one from this episode who's still alive at 93 and at 69. She did a one-woman show about sexuality and aging, so rock on, Joan Hotchkiss. There might be episodes of The Odd Couple that are more memorable, like when they go on the game show Password, or wind up in court giving us the classic line, "Never assume, because when you assume, you make an ass out of you and me," or when Felix decorates the apartment. And they were the ones with Gary's sister Penny Marshall as Oscar's secretary Myrna, or the ones featuring great 70s character actors and guest stars like Howard Cosell, Bobby Riggs, and Billie Jean King. But Sleepwalker is like a crystallization of the premise, with smart, funny writing and great performances. And I think it's a perfect canon-worthy gateway drug to the series, which is now on Hulu and Paramount Plus. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Karen. I'll start because this was my selection from our submission list. I'm going to start with what I liked about this episode, which was starting with one of the things that she called out and was my first note, the all-over print on Nancy.
Oh, my God, yes.
Gorgeous.
That ensemble and the accessorizing is canon-worthy.
Yes. Gorgeous. The purse, when she puts it on, is like, oh, mwah, everything about it is perfect. And in general, I loved all of the styling that takes us back to like the glam 70s New York of like, this is the 60s, I guess, but of like Fosse Verdon times and like Company, you know, it's like the Corningware coffee pot, all the mugs on the stand with the little swirls. Like,
I think the pot with the rump roast was Le Creuset, I'm pretty sure, but like mustard, like harvest gold. Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
And when we see them by the apartment front door, it's got those little step down and the little railings. I was like, oh, it's like Sarah's old place.
Oh, yeah. A sunken studio.
Exactly.
Mm. Yeah.
Theirs is not a studio, of course, but same thing. You can tell it was like built around the same time as that apartment that you used to live in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the styling, like, you know, Karen says it's never explained why Felix is in a tuxedo. He was at the opera.
Yeah, he was at the opera.
That was, I mean, she said it too. It was like, that seems clear to me. Like, people dressed up for stuff then.
Mm-hmm.
It was a different time.
Yeah.
And there, so let's just get into the plot though, because I don't necessarily agree that this is a great entree into the show. I did not grow up in the tri-state area, so reruns during, you know, baseball rainouts were not part of my culture. And this, I'm sure I've seen this show before, not enough to remember it. The other thing I love, music. The music is a 15 out of 10, including, like, not just the theme song, which is legendary, but even the incidental music is, like, really poppy and fun. But in terms of the plot, I just can't believe how that we're a whole season and a bit into the run of this show, and Oscar tries to be nicer to Felix has not already been an episode plot. Like, this seems very obvious. It's crazy to me that it's coming this late. And maybe it has happened before. But to me, this whole thing is like, this isn't a sitcom episode. It's a sketch. Like,
yeah.
We go through so many phases of it. And there's not really any progression to it. And, you know, if we need to have the whole thing with Murray the cop in order to have another person speaking to Felix about, like, what's going on behind Oscar's back, which, by the way, learning that Jack Klugman was 49, that's Dave's age. It looks like 35 years older than Dave.
Oh, my God. Well, I mean, that bad toupee that he had been using for 15 years.
Sure.
Klugman, not Dave, for the record.
No, Dave's hair is...
Dave's toupee is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Very lifelike.
Yep.
Yes.
Thanks.
but like, I don't know what Felix is like. Is Felix trying to get Oscar charged with something? Like, what is the purpose of having a cop other than having, like, just to be able to tell the story? Like, I guess he can't tell Nancy because then Nancy would be like, oh, I told him to try and be nicer to you, and maybe this is a side effect.
I kind of took it just as, like, your friendly neighborhood policeman, authority figure.
Yes, he's also their friend, obviously. Yeah.
Well, but there were a couple of lines where it's like, we're trying to catch him in the act, and the implication is to haul him off to the hoosegow. Like,
right.
Do you like each other at all? Like, why do you even know each other?
Yeah.
I just kind of felt like there was a burden of proof that he needed to demonstrate in order to get like this little whatever mini intervention or whatever he wanted to get going to get going.
Yeah.
I mean, it's contrived and it doesn't really hold up to scrutiny, but I didn't really get I want him incarcerated for beating me on the head with a rolled up
newspaper. Well, and also, it's pre-internet TV and there are ways that information has to be conveyed out loud for us. So
I get that. I just felt like there would have been another way that might have made more sense. Presumably they have another friend. Again, this is not a show I watched. But like ultimately, you know, Felix is insufferable. Like there's no way you can be on his side, even as he's getting hit in the head. Like he's not even gracious to Oscar in his attempts to like try to be nice to him. He's just a pill about all of it. Like when someone squeezes you juice, you fucking drink the juice, put the pits under your plate and throw them away when they're not looking. Like, acknowledge the effort that's being taken. I understand that he can't because this is the show. But there is also, like, you know, ultimately it just has to end up at like, well, this is the equilibrium of our relationship and it has to continue this way because it's a TV show. And so, you know, we start at square A and we end at square A with, because that's how sitcoms work. And there's a very similar episode of King of Queens where like therapy is attempted on Arthur because he's mad all the time. And then the therapist, who's played by William Hurt, is like, tells Carrie, stop trying to thwart him all the time. And then Carrie's miserable because she likes to fight. And then ultimately they decide, well, they're just going to go back to doing what they were doing. And Doug is going to be miserable living with conflict because all he wants is to avoid it. Same thing where it's like we're calling out what the central issue of this relationship is, but we can't change it because it's a sitcom. So,
and it's a writing issue. Yeah.
Right. Well, so this was not a successful pitch to me, but thank you for bringing Nancy's gorgeous outfit to my attention.
I think the pitch itself should go in the canon of canon pitches, because I think that I found myself sort of feeling like, well, but you know, what is the canon for after all? But to provide a record of significant blah, blah. I mean, I think that Karen did an excellent job of placing this in context, of talking about the time and the location. Our Rainout Theater shit was like Three Stooges / Buster Keaton on PIX. So maybe you had a different feed or we're not quite the same age. That's totally fine. Odd Couple is one of those shows where if I was homesick and I had the little black and white portable in my room and I was like, getting up to get a book. That's how my mother could tell it was time for me to go back to school. Is that I was just like, not sort of like laying motionless in front of whatever crappy mid-century thing happened to be on. And The Odd Couple was definitely one of those shows. Like this, Felix is a dick. Oscar is yelly. These are not characters. This plot is not a full, you know, at that time, 25, 26 minutes of plot. It's 8 minutes. And then there's just a lot of tracking around and like trying to amuse yourself looking at the unbelievable matching lamps in Felix's room or this outfit on Lady Doctor. Or like sourcing the, you know, whatever old rotary phone they're rocking in the kitchen with the super long cord. Like, it was fascinating to look at. It was fascinating to remember how certain things on TV and in film had to be coded, not just New York City, quote, urban, quote, elites. And the fact that New York City was like literally a battleground and like, where exactly did you film these credit scenes and how long did it take you? And were these, was it a guerrilla crew? Because I mean, it was fucking scary. But also all of the heavy, heavy queer coding that is happening almost in spite of itself. And then that they have to always rewrite it like in every scene. But there's, I mean, there's always something like rump roast. Like, I don't want to put that thing in my mouth. Like, okay. So I think that this show is important. And I think the way that Karen explained it and put it in the context of its time and the culture and the fact that it's like when my mother would make us watch whatever, Citizen Kane, and we're like, big whoop, a focus pull. And she's like, he invented that stuff and a bunch of other things. Like when you're watching Frasier, it's like, this has been done and been done and been done. But the fact is, Frasier exists and does it better and with more lovable, well-rounded characters whose actions seem governed by something besides the writers needing to bring them back to the same place they were at the beginning.
Yeah.
So this episode is not a success, but the presentation was excellent. Thank mm-hmm. you for making it. I don't regret watching this, but this is probably a no for me. I mean, some of the references were fun, like Ralph Nader, like we're still referring to that guy. Uh-huh. A $6 roast that, you know, mm-hmm. 50 years later, we're like, who cares? Just throw it out. Like, oh, I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. Like there's a lot here to be interested by, but as an episode of television, yeah, I just,
yeah.
Maybe if Felix were, like Tara said, gracious at any moment about anything towards anyone. Mm-hmm. But he's just a douche.
Yeah. I mean, he does get there in the end, but yeah.
Yeah.
One more thing.
After crying to get his way.
Right. Right. One more thing I forgot to say before we pass it over to Dave. She's like, we would never see this now. There are tons of middle-aged people on TV, including in sitcoms. Like, you know, The Conners has a lot of unmessed with faces, like mm-hmm. all of them. And they're, you know, people in their 40s and 50s and just like that, faces question mark. But some of them are, Cynthia Nixon's still out here, like looking like she does, you know, there. So I think TV is more of a middle-aged person's medium still. Mm-hmm. So
I mean, Good Fight, like, you know, yeah. I think we've gotten actually better about that. Procedural, still a little bit of a problem, but that's why God invented European television. Mm-hmm. Crags Galore. Speaking of Crags Galore, Dave. Just kidding. Dave's toupee.
Give me a second to adjust my toupee. Yeah. This show was on for a little while when I was young in the after school, getting home from school block, mm-hmm. like with Gilligan's Island and stuff like that. Sure. And I remember enjoying it as a kid and watching this episode. I'm trying to remember why. And I don't mean that in a mean way, but I mean, like, I don't understand how I would hook into that as a child and what is fun about that, you know, for a kid that was raised on Star Wars and just like stupid shit, like Weird Al and stuff like that, why I enjoyed this. And I...
No choice. Even bad cartoons are still cartoons theory.
No, it's not that.
Okay.
It's that people are yelling.
Yeah.
And there is very basic emotion going on in this show. And it is two diametrically opposed forces. It's almost like Good and Evil, but it's not. And so it was really easy show to digest as a child, even if you didn't understand all the things that they were doing. You understood you had dumb slob and kind of smart, fancy dude, right?
mm-hmm. Broad strokes. Yeah.
That the one guy was messy and just would fly into a rage sometime was 4 p.m. entertainment funny for me, I guess. Mm-hmm. honestly, rewatching this, it didn't do anything for me on any level. I didn't think it was that funny. I mean, yeah, it was fun to look at and seeing the Corningware coffee pot. And I were like, oh, mm-hmm. we all had that in our house.
Yep.
Like, if not that one piece, we had the casserole dish or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. We all had that blue flour somewhere in our house. Did.
Yep.
So it was fun in sort of a nostalgic way for me. But when you say that this episode is a small sketch dragged out across a half hour, it is absolutely my problem with this. It is like, it is what Saturday Night Live does wrong all the time too. It's just like a small idea that is a good X minutes and now they're doing X times 3 or X times 4. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't have the legs to go there. When you compare it with what Frasier is doing with a lot of the same elements, what they added to the table was, it's just not these two diametrically opposed forces.
Yes.
Not mm-hmm. that you have, well, I mean, you do. I guess Martin is the Klugman character in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
And
you also have a very cute dog.
Right. And you have you have two Felixes in Frasier. But they have Daphne and all these other, you know, Roz and the radio station and all these things to mitigate just the bicker, bicker, bicker comedy that comes out of that. And that's what this is missing. It is just that one thing over and over again. And I give props for the actors for selling it. They do really well. I feel like they really are in the skin of these rather simple characters, but they do it really well.
Yeah.
And they're fun to watch. But this is not enough for an episode. And certainly not enough for me to put it in the canon.
Yeah. The other thing that Frasier has, and thank you for bringing that up, Sarah, because that's a perfect comparison, is that, like, the reason that Frasier and Martin are trying to make their relationship work harmoniously is not just because they live together. It's because they are related. Like, at a certain point on this show, it would be like, you don't have to know each other. Like, if you, if this is such torture to you, one of you can move out. Like, this doesn't
I like how much real world, like, scrutiny you're putting on The Odd Couple here, Tara.
Like, I'm just saying, like, I know why that doesn't happen, but it's the same thing, like, when you watch The Housewives, where it's like, Real Housewives shows. It's like, stop knowing each other, like, block each other's numbers, like, stop being in each other's lives. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
That's
which, that's why the pandemic, to me, was good for the one Housewives franchise I allow myself, because it just reduced it right down to, like, the water level dropped and there's the shipwreck of these relationships. That's like, okay, all we do is have fights and go to parties to start new fights. And they're very open about that, which I sort of appreciated. But anyway, we're way off topic.
All right. I've had my say. So let's put this to the official vote. Tara Ariano, what say you?
I agree with Sarah. It was an excellent presentation, but it is a no for me.
Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, present anything, present as much as you want. We loved it, but this episode I did not love. So no.
So that means, unfortunately, that The Odd Couple Season 2, Episode 4, Sleepwalker, you are not inducted into the extra hot great canon. It is time for the canon. Our next entry is from our good friend, Doug Dale. Take it away, Doug.
By 2010, reality TV had broadened beyond its conceit as a sideshow of personalities, growing into a legitimate showcase of talent. Reality competitions had produced successes in their fields after airing, with American Idols on the radio and Project Runway designers having commercial success. Magical Elves, known for its success with Project Runway and Top Chef, looked to continue its run of good luck with Work of Art, The Next Great Artist. Like its predecessors, Work of Art took 14 hopefuls in their field, here visual art, and put them through various challenges each week, resulting with one winner and $100,000 and a show at the Brooklyn Museum. While the show was canceled after two seasons and did not produce any stars, Work of Art managed to produce some oddly charming television, examining the thought process of creatives and what exactly goes into executing gallery work. Season 1, Episode 2, The Shape of Things to Come, is one of the most successful episodes at showcasing the cast's range of skills, personalities, and general TV-worthy moments. It all begins with a classic prompt, which I could explain, but it'll sound better coming from auctioneer Simone de Pierry, who essentially acts as Tim Gunn, but with a truly wild accent.
As you can see, we brought you to an appliance graveyard to find the materials for this next challenge. Your challenge is to use at least one of those appliances for your next work of art. How you do this is entirely up to you, but it has to be three-dimensional. It has to be sculptural.
I also want to argue that this show even belongs in the canon, since I can already smell a King of Queens counter-argument. Work of Art is an excellent show of reality TV for a bevy of reasons. And I'll start with my weakest argument first. So, point one, it produces good art? To be honest, final works are the least interesting part of the show. A lot of it can be hokey or up its own ass, as a lot of contemporary art is. But there are some interesting flashes of beauty in Nicole's TV tomb, or Peregrine's functional monitor salvaged from a pile of what's supposed to be clunkers. Even the guest judge John Kessler's guidance before the challenge is slightly sweet, if not bizarre, but in a very classic artist sentiment.
Objects have memory. They have a life. There's something romantic and poetic and mysterious about a found object. They might have been under a Christmas tree. They might have been the possession of a dead man. And I think that's something you should think about as you pick your found object.
Let's just jump right into point two, the processes. One of the wondrous things that work of art has going for it is the truly fascinating sausage making of watching a piece go from concept to sketch for execution to real-time edits and changes until the final product is a weird compromise between the idea and its reality. It's a rare portrayal of creativity, watching some artists mushing around until they latch onto something specific. Abdi's idea of a family of spray foam figures gets tweaked and tweaked and tweaked until it just becomes one child made of tape and plaster and whatnot. Can we also please acknowledge what some of the artists have to show at the end of one full workday? Abdi is left with just a fucking hunk of wire, Judith is still moving bits of cord around, and Jacqueline spends a full day caulking a tank that does not even hold water. It's fucking infuriating and agonizing and absolutely true to how creative people work before poping out a fully formed piece before the deadline. These people are somehow professionals and toddlers, and it's ridiculous.
I just got it in my hair. What a-
Gorilla glue?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're probably cutting that down.
Really?
Oh, definitely.
Are you serious? It won't come out with water?
No, no way.
Oh my god.
And I ripped it out.
This is the worst project I've ever done in my entire life.
Gorilla glue is literally the strongest glue that you can get. The only thing that you can do at that point with Jackie is to just lie your ass off.
I would die if I had to cut off my hair.
No, 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 you're not gonna have to.
Are you sure?
I'm positive, yeah.
I hate you.
Which takes us to point three, the personalities. Work of art is particularly excellent in its choice to focus on artists, a group of people that are naturally weird and performative and infuriating in their daily lives even without television producers. Just like the early days of something like Drag Race, you don't need production to pull strings or start conflict. This group of weirdos will do it all on their own. Prime example is Miles, a studio assistant whose work stems from his history with OCD. Miles regularly tries to murder his competition with toxic fumes, and in this episode, sculpts some gigantic concrete assholes.
Miles is spreading toxic chemicals everywhere, and people are starting to, you know, get headaches and feel a little sick.
This is not gonna work. Miles, do you have a cover for that bin?
Yeah.
Thank you.
To fully get at how I was feeling when I walked into the appliance graveyard, I'm making the hardest place to sleep possible. I start making the bed. I screen printed an electrical map on the top of my fiberglass mattress. And then I made two concrete ass just for the sake of having an icon of like tension there.
During the gallery opening, Miles sleeps on his piece, a bed, and later wins the challenge. Throughout the series, he stars in a showmance, sets various things on fire, mixes up mustard gas, you know, normal TV stuff. Off the show, Miles spoke openly about his choice to compete as an exaggerated version of himself, going so far as to work with an established artist to plan out the character before shooting. While this portrayal of neurodivergence is massively problematic, and let's face it, Miles seems straight up punchable, it's interesting to watch it play out on a reality TV show, focusing on fine arts, where performance and theatrics are encouraged. Both the show and the contestants are taking advantage of one another, resulting in an Ouroboros of self-referential TV. It's not exactly deep, but it's interesting to watch the gaming of a system that loves to be gamed. Also, this is episode two, so I think just that point alone deserves its own chapter in the fucked up history of reality TV textbook. I also want to stress that not every angle of the show is this cynical. A lot of the show is sweet people discovering beauty on their own terms and trying to express it, usually badly. Which leads us to the infamous point four, the explanations.
Okay, Judith.
Well, when we went to the electronics graveyard, we were faced with so many different things. I didn't have a plan. Little by little, I started getting kind of a meaning out of the cords and that they carry current and it's about energy. And
like this thing suggests maybe it's picking up sounds from the universe or whatever, but obviously, you know, it doesn't.
The wires reaching out and all this, the grid, you know.
In a way.
I mean, it had a story, but it was just that. I think it means it. Okay, thank you.
I don't know if you are a Judith, or you've been taught by a Judith, or your mom's best friend is a Judith, but we all know a Judith. Work of Art is a precious series to me, as it was my first exposure to contemporary art, a movement that has buried its talent in punchlines and disposability, because apparently artists don't have value unless it's 50 years after their peak, and we need to be able to bemoan how wonderful things used to be before we start giving a shit. I owe my passion and what little career I have to this dumb show. And as much of a mess as Work of Art is, it does an impeccable job portraying messy people in a messy industry using the messy medium of reality TV. Whether you hate these fuckers or are touched by their strangeness or just want to gawk at the zoo animals, there is no denying that Work of Art is peak reality TV and deserves a spot on the wall of the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Doug Dale, thank you so much. I selected this one from our list of options because I just felt like nobody else was ever going to select it because Doug, my friend, one of the lights of my life, I think you and I were the only people who watched the shtees. I tried to get other people to watch it because it is kind of a batshit show that, like Doug says, is also very sincere, like very earnest in what it's trying to do. And I think part of what it's trying to do is to open up the process of creating visual art and the tasks that that artists sometimes have to set themselves for people who, like myself, cannot draw a stick figure, and like family members would get on my team in Pictionary and then like run screaming into the snowy night because I couldn't draw anything. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. Like when the winner was crowned, I won't spoil anything, but I did go to the show at the Brooklyn Museum and I was quite taken by it. They crammed it into some fourth floor gallery behind a bunch of like sliding panels, and it was like a little bit sad but also quite interesting to see this stuff that you've been seeing made on TV for 10 weeks. Simone de Puri, the everybody's continental art dilf. I fucking love Simone. I'm a little sad that a season 2 episode was not selected because one of my favorite things in the world is when there was this performance artist named, or a graffiti artist named Suck Lord in the second season. And to hear Simone have to say Suck Lord like numerous times for weeks, this guy hung on for a while, I think probably because America needed to hear this like Belgian Richie saying the word Suck Lord. Now, is this admittedly avant-garde, ironically, rationale for a canon submission enough? I think it is. I was taken in again by the show, even though I remember who won. And I've already watched it. Peregrine, fucking spare me. Neo, fucking spare me. But then, and then Miles sort of doing an installation by being a dick at Crit. But here's the other thing. I was an arts major. Like I dealt with crits for 3 years in university. It wasn't visual arts, but like the bull crit is so funny to me and so relatable and so painful. And just watching like this gallery owner, Bill Powers, like not even realizing how, like what kindling he's reducing people's dreams to, just a passing comment. But like, I was bored by this. And she's just like crumbling from the inside. I mean, it just was very familiar and yet somehow very TV friendly. Like I'm not exactly sure how they did it. And frankly, I don't think the show exactly works. Like I'm not sure it should have been a competitive reality show. I'm not sure they should have done that thing that they always do on Project Runway, where it's like, stay in your lane, except when we order you to get out of it. Unconventional materials. Why didn't you make a ball gown? Like, I think if some people are photographers and other people are used to, you know, like Bruce Nauman type stuff, like Trong, who got eliminated in this episode on specious grounds, in my opinion, you know, I'm not sure that the way the show is structured really works as a competition or should be a competition. I said the same thing about Top Design. But for what it's trying to do, like, it gets pretty close. It lets people who don't really know anything about this stuff feel like they're learning something but not being lectured. It's not boring. It's fun to think about and fun to actually watch it being made. Like, I love Project Runway, but even that sometimes is like, okay, all these sequins are going on. Like, I don't, you know, this is not all that interesting to watch. Fast forward. I was wondering how this was going to be presented and how Doug was going to find their way in to this topic. And I think they did a really good job, but also I'm already kind of in the bag for this show. So I'm really interested to hear what Tara and Dave have to say, but great presentation. It was a delight to revisit this. And even though you have to pay for the episodes, which is infuriating, hey, Bravo app, bring them back. I wanted to watch the next one, and that's definitely a canon criterion for me. So thank you so much, Doug. And I'm going to probably go buy the rest of the season and watch it because I have a very full life. Tara.
Yeah. What do we have Peacock for if it's not to rehabilitate these like weird one or two seasons?
Seriously.
I know we've prosecuted this before, but every giant conglomerate gets one streaming service and you put all your shit on that one streaming service. I am not a crackpot.
All your shit.
All of
Benson
it.
Benson 2. Not a crackpot.
Nope.
Anyway.
That is a work of art.
I didn't watch this, so this was my first episode. And learning at the end of it that Doug was, is a visual artist, makes me kind of intimidated to give a crit to Doug's presentation because, like, I certainly don't know more about art than they do, but here we go anyway. I certainly
you
was
know
not
what you
expecting.
Like?
I certainly was not expecting King of Queens to get name dropped twice in the same episode, and the second time by not me, but sure. My feeling when the episode started was like, what a weird idea for a show. Like, mm-hmm. I know why they did it. As Doug said, like, this is a format that they had shown worked with other, you know, creative fields. So, okay. But as a non-expert, I feel like this is not really how art gets made. Like, you know, the part of
oh,
art.
Oh, no, it isn't.
And I mean, it's the same that you could say the same thing about Project Runway, and we certainly have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but here's the difference.
Yeah.
Project Runway and being in the fashion industry is about having a business and making it thrive.
Yes.
I think people that went on work of art are sort of a self-selecting type of artist.
Right.
That the spotlight is very important to their process, perhaps. And that changes the type of art you get, the stuff and the approach and all that, where you get people like Trong who mm-hmm. basically put three tweets on television and try to pass it as art.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great comparison. Yeah. And, you know, I thought the art that was produced was some bullshit. Mm-hmm. And to Doug's point, like, maybe that's part of what the show is trying to do in like a meta way. I mean, you know, the word Ouroboros did come up, I believe. Maybe that was in mm-hmm. the Odd Couple. I forget. But anyway,
Ouroboros couple.
But like, I mean, you know, Trong's is bad. I think that was a deserved boot. That's a very, like, when we see it, it's like, it's a very Banksy idea. And I don't mean that as a compliment. Like, you know, woo, three TVs watching another TV. Ooh. And one of them says, I hate reality TV. How dare? He's so bold.
Yeah, I mean, okay.
But Abdi's is also bad. Like, it's well executed, but it's like a child with a TV head holding a video game controller.
And
like,
the umbilical, yeah. I mean, yeah.
I mean, there is no.
Is that
I
the most Hulk opaque symbology? Yeah.
Yes. I need Hulk hands to make my jerk off motion as big as it deserves to be for this situation. You know, I agree with Doug that there were some that were kind of, you know, interesting, especially given like the constraints that were on it just by how the process works. But I mean, Miles, it doesn't endear him to me more to know that like this was, he was doing essentially doing a bit this whole time.
No.
But like the idea that this was the bit you do, like, oh, I'm real sleepy. Like, what? Falling asleep at like the graveyard is like, go outside. Why are you like this? And then falling asleep on his thing, like, again, very performatively, like, okay, fine. And like breaking in on the crit. Okay, got it. He's a dick. But I just, like, it was not. I don't know. I feel like I spent the whole time, because as often happens when we're presented with an episode of reality TV that where it's something that we don't watch, I was sort of waiting the whole time for like, what is the moment that makes this one stand out among all the rest? Like, you know, when we're watching a Real Housewives, again, to bring that up again, like there's always a thing that happens where you're like, oh, that's why.
Right. Like a table gets turned over and you're like, hey, here we are.
Whatever. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a particularly memorable or vicious or whatever fight. But this was just sort of like, I mean, okay. Like nothing really happened that made me see like, okay, I get why this one above all the others. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the buttholes are a whole separate issue. But
I thought the construction of the buttholes, just like this very simple way that he put a whole bunch of cement in a bag.
Mm-hmm. In a bag and then punched it. Yep.
And then just stuck something in the middle so it would all pucker up and have a nice butthole. I thought that was pretty smart.
Yeah. I just don't get how it relates to the bed.
No, it doesn't.
Not as smart as he thought it was. Yeah. Right. I mean, one of the things that I enjoyed was like occasionally that they would be explaining or like testing out their crit pitch to the camera during a talking head.
Yeah.
And then there would be just this eye slide that was like, did you buy that? Like,
oh yeah.
Yes. Been there.
Yeah, that's another meta moment or meta aspect of it. That's
in this villanelle, I will discuss the onset of menses. Like, okay,
yeah. We heard that definitely in the John Kessler clip too, where it's sort of like he is steering them in a certain way to be like, come up with a bullshit story for your explanation of like it's very romantic. These objects, they might have been under a Christmas tree. Maybe they belong to a dead person. It's like, settle down, John.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's I get why people liked it, but it did not totally work for me. Dave.
I don't like reality shows like this to start with, like Project Runway, also similarly disinterested. Oh boy, stroke.
Suck Lord.
So I wasn't really pre-sold on this whatsoever. And a couple just big structural problems I have with the show is when they get whatever, let's say 10 people on the competition in various artistic disciplines, whether they be sculpture, painting, multimedia, and then say, now you're going to do a sculpture competition. I feel like, well, why? What are you doing? I mean, you're just stacking the deck against people here. And I feel like these are the tropes of reality television that always turn me off, which is like manufactured failure.
Agree.
Or success sometimes, you know, the flip side of that. And I really do think that artists that would go on this show are the type of artists I'm the least interested in. You would be tempted to think Andy Warhol might go on the show if he existed now or it existed back then.
He fully would.
But I think, I don't know if he would. It would depend on what period in time you catch him at, right? If you caught him right in between, you know, drawing soup cans for corporation, just as he was starting to draw soup cans for, you know, rich people that live in penthouses. Mm-hmm. Maybe, but I feel like there is a certain quintessential internetness to the type of artist that you would get to come on a TV show and where they have to be in their careers to really feel like they're going to benefit from this type of exposure.
Yeah, it's not an accident that so many of them are in their 20s. Mm-hmm. In some cases, they're quite early 20s. Well, I mean,
that's also
too.
Just
that's casting
fucking,
as well. Yes, of course.
And the other big structural problem is in addition to just having too many disciplines and not enough challenges that somehow can play into everybody's strength,
yep.
is that how do you judge an art show on any criteria beyond like, this speaks to me on a certain level or it doesn't speak to me on a certain level? There was right. one guy who owned a gallery. Now, if he kept on saying, I could sell this for yeah. X amount of dollars, yeah. no problem, then I would like, you know, I don't want to reduce art to that, but at least that's a metric I could understand.
yeah.
Whereas everybody else is just doing that bullshit art frou-frou-ness where they just try to, you know, think of ways to impress your seminar lead so you get your marks and then you're out the door.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, that I'd like to interrogate the use of concrete. Like, again, I get it. But one of the things I liked is how subjective the judging is. That it's just like that we were given no... we were given sort of no criteria, no framework. It's all over the place in terms of the disciplines. Like you said, I totally agree that that's a structural problem. But I kind of found watching the show appealing for that reason, that it's like so much of everything, of the judgment of everything is subjective. And as right. a cultural critic, it was fascinating to look at this show telling on itself and its own structural problems well. With every second. But
look, Sarah, if you want to embrace the chaos, that's your business. I disagree. I find it very frustrating to gamify this sort of
totally fair.
Output. And if they did something else, like more of a real world setup where it's like, let's take eight artists, we'll stick them in a house, and they're all going to have a debut at the same gallery in 2 months' time.
Yeah,
and
then let's agree with
see
that too.
What happens when people stop. Playing nice and start being realistic
and start making concrete buttholes.
So I was just like frustrated about from this episode from stem to stern. That's not to say like there aren't some moments, you know, when the old lady who made the clump of wires thing just like couldn't shut up. I'm like, yeah. oh, that's me. When you like you start talking and nobody's reacting to what you're saying. mm-hmm. So you just, well, I better talk more. You know, smash cut 8 minutes later. Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I'm purly web sweating. My pits are in the next county. Mm-hmm. Like, those are just like small human moments that any show can, you know, generate. But
yes.
you know, those are the moments that I, you know, I did like about this. But I just find structurally, base level, I don't like the premise of this show. And I feel like it just can never really be a competitive reality show if you're going to mix so many disciplines and like just have a willy-nilly, artsy-fartsy, hoity-toity judge panel. And I just don't think those two things mix. And I don't think they right. really should mix unless you do things and it's like, all right, listen up, fuckers. All I want from you is commercial art.
Yeah.
And that's how we're going to judge it. Like, that's a different type of show and mm-hmm. you're not going to get all the same types of entertainingly obtuse personalities when you do that kind of thing. But that could be mm-hmm. judged more fairly. That show was Face Off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or just right. like bring in one discipline per episode and have it mm-hmm. be a fucking winner take all crit or yeah. like do a bunch of, I mean, I wrote about this at the time. Like there were a bunch of ways that they could have made this a little more quote fair. Mm-hmm. But the fact that this show was a complete platypus was part of what I loved about it. Also that no sure. one watched it except me, Doug, and Monty, I forgot to say. Hi, Monty.
But let me just temper everything I said by this. Like, if you like reality shows, not for the competition, not for the projects that they create, but just for the drama that all that engenders, like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. I understand you coming from that perspective. You're like, wow, look at these fuck knuckles. They're so stupid. They're so young. And they're just putting out shit and trying to bullshit their way to the next round. I understand that you can approach mm-hmm. on that level and enjoy it. Not
who amongst
not,
us.
Not something I can do. That is mm-hmm. not how I can approach reality television. I approach it way too scientifically.
I'll definitely give Doug this. We do all know a Judith.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Or possibly we are a Judith sometimes mm-hmm. in Dave's case. And the only yeah. problem in life is that we, unlike Jerry Saltz, can't just give her a time outside. Oh my God, like,
the TOs. Like, he was just smiling so gently. I mean,
he was.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the other thing that I forgot to say again, sorry to once again butt in after I'm supposedly done. The whole thing with the fumes coming off of Miles' materials is, I mean, it, I just thought how much that room must smell in general. Like, given everything everyone else is doing, like, they're sawing, they're, like, cutting up cords. Like, it just must have been completely noxious and so loud. So I definitely have empathy for anyone who could produce anything in that environment because it sounds like hell on earth.
Yeah, but that guy with whatever he was doing that created those fumes, it kind of felt like he's like using rubber cement or something like that. Like,
yeah.
They showed people doing stuff outside. Go outside for that shit.
Yeah, well, that guy's a dick.
Yes. All right, let's put this to the vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
I mean, it's not going to get in, but I really am glad someone tried it. And Doug, email me if you want to talk. It's a yes for me, but let's get this over with.
Yeah, you and Doug could have a like rewatch book club if you
Dork
do
of art.
Season.
Yeah, yes, let's do it.
That's what I mean. It's a no for me, but Doug, as always, thank you so much. We love your presentation.
Yeah, they're always great. And Sarah, I'm happy for you, but I'm also going to say no to this one.
I'm happy for all of us.
All right, that means work of art, colon, the next great artist, question mark. I added that part. Season 1, Episode 2, The Shape of Things to Come. I'm sad to report you're not in the extra hot great canon. All right, before we get to our third and final canon presentation, I want to tell you about what's coming up in the Extra Hot Great Cinematic Universe. On the next Extra Hot Great Prime, it is NBC's The Endgame with Crystal Farmer of the 2 Cents Plus Tax podcast. And then on Extra Extra Hot Greats, both 167 and 168, we have, respectively, a Baldwin Thunderdome or a Baldwin Thunderdome.
Yep.
I'm not sure which one we're going with.
The
and
second.
I don't want to know. Is it all just about Adam Baldwin's fighting each other?
You're so close.
And then,
yes,
on the next Extra Extra Hot Crate, that'll be on Tuesday, February 22nd, we have TV's Best Cheap Dates and Worst Pricey Ones. Those are available to all our supporters at any level. Go to patreon.com/extrahotcrate to join today. All right, let's get to our third and final presentation from our friend Dave in Chicago.
This is Dave in Chicago with a canon submission that may seem unseasonal depending on when you air it, but I will argue is perennial and evergreen. I'm not sure if younger generations are really that aware of Pee-wee Herman now, but in the 1980s, he was really a force. He was everywhere, an original creation that seemingly everyone was familiar with. A joke that is kind of hard to explain, but people were on board with it anyway. Pee-wee Herman had 2 movies in the 80s, would pop up for random cameos in other movies and TV, and even hosted Saturday Night Live in character. And of course, he was the star of Pee-wee's Playhouse for 5 seasons from 1986 to 1990. When it comes to his regular TV gig on the Playhouse, it might seem hard to single out just one episode for the canon. Although I think a case could also be made for the episode where Pee-wee says that he loves fruit salad, and then everyone else says, well, if you love fruit salad so much, why don't you marry it? And then Pee-wee actually goes through with it and marries the fruit salad. But today I'd like to argue on behalf of a different episode, the 1988 Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas Special, one of the rare TV specials that actually earns the word special. Playhouse started as a riff on children's television tropes that still actually worked as kids' entertainment. The Christmas special shifts gears slightly and is more of a takeoff on all-star variety shows, but once again, it serves as a great and functional example of the same thing that they're making fun of. There's not a lot of story to be found. Pee-wee and the usual Playhouse gang are getting ready for Christmas. Celebrity guests keep dropping by or calling in to wish them happy holidays. Pee-wee is a little too greedy with all the presents he wants, and everyone keeps giving him fruitcakes instead.
So, excuse me, Miss Yvonne, but before you go make it out with everyone in the Playhouse, how about forking over the gift?
Here you go, Pee-wee.
Wow,
really heavy.
What is it, a gold brick?
No, but it's just as priceless. It's my very own special homemade Christmas fruitcake.
fruitcake?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Bond.
One thing that works about this episode is that it's funny if you know who the celebrities are, but it's sometimes even funnier if you don't. The guests are introduced but rarely explained. They just show up to do their part. The idea that Pee Wee Herman knows Charo and Joan Rivers abruptly roots the playhouse in the real world as we know it, while making absolutely no concessions to reality. In one instance, they casually mention that the sentient computer Magic Screen and basketball player Magic Johnson are cousins. Everyone still acts like Pee Wee is the most famous person in the room and the center of everything, which is really a smart choice. It's a world where young audiences might innocently assume that the Del Rubio triplets and Oprah Winfrey are the same amount of famous. Although even Pee-wee gets just a little starstruck when Cher drops in, fresh off her moonstruck Oscar win.
That was Cher! Cher was right there! In the same room as my chair! I hope I didn't stare. Oh well, I don't care.
I'm sure that everyone who sees this will have their own favorite bits and cameos. I'm partial to Pee-wee's casual disregard for Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon while they demonstrate how to make Christmas cards with potato stamps.
I hope you don't forget to wash that potato before you eat it.
All right, I'm going to have to separate you two. Now get back to work. I need 500 of each of those by sundown.
500?
When it comes to the canon, I think and hope that this is an obvious choice. Pee-wee Herman was huge to the 80s pop culture landscape, arguably helping to kickstart a more self-aware, kids and adults can both get the joke trend that would continue through the 90s. The Christmas special is a great showcase of what the Playhouse did best, using Pee-wee's tendency to be a brat to set us all up for a lesson about the true meaning of Christmas. But it also makes room for childlike wonder and innocence, as when Pee-wee gets super excited just when it starts to snow. Also, since the Extra Hot Great canon more regularly celebrates episodic television, it's maybe harder to honor certain other areas of television history, such as variety shows and holiday specials. The Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special is an opportunity to nod in that direction. Who needs layered narrative payoffs when you can have Joyful Mania and a rockabilly Katie Lang performing at an 11? So, esteemed Extra Hot Great panel, won't you make my holiday wish come true and induct the Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special into the canon? I promise I've been extra good this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave in Chicago. This was my pick from the available canon entries in our big basket of canon entries. By the way, thank you all so much for submitting those. Anytime you want to submit one, you just go to extrahotgreat.com, hit that info hub, and all the information on how to submit and what to submit and some hints and tips are all there. All right, let's get into Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special from 1988. We started to watch this, and then I realized I somehow missed this when it was on. So this was actually the first time I have seen this. I watched the Playhouse on CBS Saturday morning quite often, even though I was well into my teenage years. Mm-hmm. I just kind of liked, I loved Pee-wee's Big Adventure. It is one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. There are three movies that I think don't get their due as true American classics. And I don't want to like say, no, actually I do. I don't want to get shit for comparing these three movies to something like Citizen Kane, which is like a bona fide, you know, Criterion Collection American classics. But those three movies that should be in the same breath when we talk about real American classics are Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yes.
Midnight Run.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. Big Trouble in Little China. Those are the three for me that are like, they're not unpopular. They're just not, they don't get enough kudos for what
they're not
done.
Respected.
Yeah,
they're not respected.
They're also Poppy Fields movies, all three of them.
Mm-hmm. I know my Pee-wee is what I'm saying coming into this, even though somehow I missed this the first time. One of the best things about this, and it's just sort of like, there's an undercurrent of Pee-wee Herman doesn't give a shit to everything he does. And the great thing about this special for me is that they get dozens of guest stars, some of which are only on screen for 2 seconds, like Oprah Winfrey pops up and then she's gone. And it all just plays into Pee-wee being the center of the universe. And the acquiescence of everybody to him is just puts it like off kilter, and it gives it this weird energy that like goes through the whole episode. And like Dave, my favorite part in the whole episode was sort of like this slave labor-esque Christmas card thing that the Beach Blanket Bingo couple are doing.
Oh my God.
And it is genuinely sort of mean-spirited. Mm-hmm. And those are the moments I feel like that separate Pee Wee Herman from everybody else that tries to do something where it's like, it's for kids, but it's also for, you know, the parents or also for whomever are not kids in the room. Mm-hmm. That he is not afraid to like do that sort of material where it's just like, oh, I can also be an asshole, mm-hmm. you know, in addition to, you know, loving goofy shit from the 50s or whatever else is going on, you know, depending on who is visiting, whether there's Cowboy Curtis or the mail lady or whatever.
Lieutenant mail lady to you.
Yes. Chunk, chunk. The other thing I liked about this episode, and it might be me reading into it, because when Dave said the thing about, you know, it all sort of ends with the true meaning of Christmas. That, the true meaning of Christmas thing, seemed like Pee Wee Herman was like, all right, fine, we'll do it. Like, there's a network note. And then he's like, oh, fine, all right, we'll mention Jesus Christ. But the first draft of this absolutely did not mention God or Jesus or anything like that. Because Pee Wee Herman's Christmas exists in the North Pole of it all. And that is it.
Yep.
And the segment just before the true meaning of Christmas segment was the, all right, get ready, Juice. Here comes your 30 seconds. Happy Hanukkah. Here's a dinosaur family celebrating Hanukkah in their little dinosaur mouse cave. I don't know what was going on there.
No, Dinosaurian Goliath. It was very bizarre.
It was just like perfectly off kilter, but also it was like, it was tokenism, but it was also like a celebration of tokenism at the same, not a celebration, but a send up of tokenism at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like it was subversive to an older crowd and like younger kids of just like, woof, you know, it's like dinosaurs. Yeah, I like dinosaurs. Yeah. So like that is the magic of when Pee Wee is actually doing good work. I do want to say, like, after watching this and seeing how well Pee Wee Herman translated in Big Adventure, I don't think Tim Burton gets enough credit for what he brought to that, because there is a mischievousness that is amped up in that movie that I don't quite see in Pee Wee's Playhouse. They're different treatments. Mm-hmm. One's a road movie. This one is a variety show. Regular Pee Wee's Playhouse was like a howdy doody kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that movie is so perfect. It is such a gem that I just, like, comparing the two, I can see by the absence of things in this special versus the movie, what Tim Burton brought to that movie. And it's fun to bag on Tim Burton now for being the Tim Burton-esque Tim Burton that ever Burtoned with everything he did after this. You know, like, oh, we've got cliffs that end in spirals. Tim Burton! That kind of thing. But, like, Pee-wee's Big Adventure is, like, just a perfect movie.
Yeah.
So, anyway, really, I really enjoyed this. I think Pee-wee Herman is great. I always have. And I'm really happy that Dave brought this to us. Sarah!
I had never seen an episode of the show before. We saw Big Adventure so many times in my house that my brother, I feel confident if the fate of humanity rested on his being able to replicate every single frame and sound effect, that he could do it and would save us all. Yep. And I saw it many times too. And I am with Dave. I think that should be in the American Film Institute's top 50.
One of those films that the Library of Congress decides to preserve for all time with whatever they do to those movies. Yeah.
Yeah. Or they like send it into space with a probe, like in Voyager 3, that it's
right next
like
to those seeds in Finland in that deep freeze place. Just in case.
And smallpox. Just kidding. So I wasn't really sure what to expect, and also a Christmas special. Who knows? But there's something about the attitude of the show. First of all, it understands that it is for kids, but it also understands that kids are not stupid or deaf. So there's not a lot of over-explaining things. It's not like a PBS instructive show. And it's not like there is the yelling with the secret word, which I must have seen some episodes at some point, because like I just had a reflex response of doing it along with the people on the show. And I know my brother did it. But that they just kind of, there's not like that extremely big, extremely bright, extremely screechy thing that a lot of kids shows that are, I don't know, like a lot of Disney product, even for older kids and tweens, is just like a sensory barrage that's like uncomfortable. Like I don't, it's like too loud. Mm-hmm. This is not pitched, even though Pee-wee's voice is like, that timbre is not everybody's favorite. It's like pitched correctly to be, sort of interest and, inviting without you feeling like you're being aurally assaulted. And the pacing is perfect. Like, what the fuck is Grace Jones doing on a kid's show? Oh, yeah. Well, she was in a box that was misaddressed.
Yeah.
And so she's like, well, since I'm here, can I do a number? And Pee-wee's like, fine. And everyone else is like, yay. And she does a short number. She gets back in the box. That's it. This is really smart.
Not only misaddressed, originally she was going to go to the White House, yeah, and it went there. So there's a story some writer in the Pee-wee's Playhouse writer room had a backstory for that. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to see that. Like, I feel like that is a whole other 15-minute short movie,
yes,
you know,
about, oh God, totally,
the espionage and whatever's going on there.
Behind mm-hmm. the Playhouse, yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. But she, like, and everyone who's there is like totally into it and totally fine with that Pee-wee is the sun in this solar mm-hmm. system. They're, yes, totally fine with that. And that Grace Jones, like, this is all being done for the amusement of like Pee-wee and whatever adults happen to be watching this, but they also understand, like, you can't have Grace Jones on screen. Like, this is not the Tonight Show. You can't have a 10-minute segment and be like, you know, blowing sunshine up her ass about how great she is. Like, she is. She looks fantastic. Yeah. She's thrilled to be there. So is Cher. But it's like a 90-second segment. And like some of these dinosaurs of show business, like Dinah Shore, who, that was, I think, my favorite bit, is when they cut back to her and she's taken the Days of Christmas up to like 20, just talking about VCRs and shit. And then he just like crawls back out of the... It's so good. Like, it's so deft with the pacing. He's doing what interests him, and that, like, that production is doing what they think is fun and interesting, and just mm-hmm. throwing it all in a blender and expecting you to keep up. And if you don't care for, like, whatever that ancient Heckle and, it wasn't Heckle and Jekyll,
right,
thank God, but like, yeah, that era, sure, cartoon, it's like, this will be over in 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. If you don't care for this segment,
yeah,
it's like Caribbean weather, new systems coming through.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was so, I don't know, it was just so fun and good natured. And even though it is premised in a no small part on Pee-wee being a brat, he's just like such a sort of average, like non-malign brat. He's just like a kid.
Yeah.
Selfish, yes, wants toys. Yes. Mm-hmm. Like, well, the rest of the world needs toys too. And he's like, and there's a long pause, like, yeah, who amongst us? I mean, mm-hmm, yeah, there is an alchemy to it that, like, I have my theories about why it all works so well. And a lot of it is pacing, and a lot of it is confidence in its own concept and putting him at the center. It's like beautiful to look at. There are some weird things, like K.D. Lang in a like honky tonk skirt, like Patsy Cline dress outfit. I was mm-hmm. like, this is a lot of information. I'm not, it's not unwelcome. I just wasn't expecting
that was one of her career phases, though. That, yeah, was like, she was that for a little while. Mm-hmm.
She also was like, so, she was so young. Like, everybody is so young. Everybody is so young. I love the outfits on the triplets. Like, it was just really fun. And it also believed that it was fun, but it wasn't so like manic and desperate about it like some Christmas specials and kids shows and kids Christmas shows can be.
Yeah.
So this was a delight. I was glad to visit this. Also, fucking Cowboy Curtis is hot. I'm sorry. I have problems. We'll talk about them later. Tara.
I mean, how do you think he got Gina Torres, Sarah? Come on now.
I don't have to think about it. Come on.
No, you don't. This is hilarious. It was great. I didn't remember all of it, but there were certainly bits of it that I remembered when they happened. Like when Annette shows Pee-wee how she's making a stencil using a toothbrush. And then he's like, remember to wash that before you brush your teeth. And she looks straight at the camera and smiles, and her teeth are all green.
Her teeth are green.
Oh, yeah. So I remember that. I remembered the Cher bit. I remembered Grace Jones. So, like, I definitely watched this at the time. You guys have already talked about a lot of the stuff that was most delightful. I mean, the fruitcake runner, it goes all the way around to being funny again. But
Several times.
It does. Like it starts great when he's like clunk, clunk, clunk on the TV, needs a dolly to take it to the kitchen. And then everyone brings them, King of Cartoons brings two. And eventually the payoff is I'm building a whole new wing on the Playhouse made entirely of fruitcake. And we cut to the construction happening. And it's two shirtless guys.
Beefcake working with fruitcake. Yeah. Uh-huh. I just was like, okay, that's it. This is going in. And there's no explanation.
Yeah, no, no.
And then they're like, let's light the tree. Like, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Who is this like, for? Me?
Yeah, kids need to know. Sometimes contractors are real handsome and their shirts are off and it's great. yeah, the other thing that was striking because we watched this after we watched Work of Art is how good it looks. The version that's on Apple TV was like remastered in recent years, and like Work of Art clearly wasn't because no one at Bravo cares, obviously, that's not streaming anywhere. But it was just funny like how crisp and bright it is, and it really lets you see all the detail, not just of the set, which is its own thing. Like there's nowhere, there's nothing on that space that isn't like compelling to the eye, but also like the whole opening claymation bit where it's like a little fox running through the snowy fields is like really beautiful and well done.
Yeah, it was cute.
Which is, you know,
very Wes Anderson in the best way.
Mm-hmm, strangely touching. But yeah, he's a brat like a child, I have in my notes. So I was glad that term came up in Dave's presentation because one of the other things I remembered was him hanging everybody's stockings and then bringing his out. And it's like as tall as him, like a sleeping bag sized stocking.
Yeah. And there's two of them.
Yeah. It's so sweet. Dave, your point about Tim Burton when you're like, it's a bummer when he became a parody of himself. It's even more of a bummer that now, like, he's directing live-action Disney adaptations. Mm-hmm. Like, the Dumbo that just came out a couple of years ago was his, where it's like, oh, no.
Who asked?
Don't be this guy. The Dinosaur, the 12 Days of Christmas going up to 500. I mean, just the little bits of it that we saw accurately portrays the experience of suffering through a rendition of the 12 Days of Christmas, like truly a torturous carol that should be retired.
Who among us has not wanted to put a self mannequin in the phone booth and just be like, I'm not doing this year. Yeah. Totally get it.
But the last thing I just want to say to anyone who wants to watch this show, first of all five seasons are on Hoopla. If you have that service, you can buy them on Amazon or Google Plus. Apple only has one season. But I also wanted to say there is definitely a straight line from this show to At Home with Amy Sedaris, the true TV show that was on a few years ago. If you missed it at the time, it's on HBO Max now. And it's a very, like, extremely similar vibe, including, like, only the hippest people will come and guest star on it. And everyone is just a little jewel box like this. So thank you, Dave, in Chicago, for bringing it to us. It's filled me with the Christmas spirit here in February. And I was happy to revisit it.
All right, let's put this to the official vote just after we thank all our submitters this week for their canon presentations. Thank you so much. Remember, if you want to put yours in, extrahotgreat.com. So let us vote on Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes, please.
Tara.
Yes.
I'm going to vote yes, too, so... That means Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas Special. That is from 1988. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
I just want to say Merry Christmas, and I'll see you in 2 years.
Maybe.
Yeah, right. Maybe. Bye.
Bye!
We chose that clip. That was before all the Whoopi Goldberg stuff came out, because that's quite apropos now. She's not going to get that call back.
No.
Eep.